Medical examiners must be approved by the Department of Public Safety, Simpson said in a 2012 interview. I had heard that Hain was soliciting coroners to set up these independent districts, I guess they're calling them. I would say to the coroners, this is not wise. Where are you going to do these autopsies? They won't be allowed to use the state lab. Hood's move seemed to irritate Simpson so much that he started speaking more freely about Hain. To me, the most troubling thing about this is that these coroners and prosecutors want to use the services of a medical examiner who isn't board certified, who does way more autopsies than he should, and who wouldn't be subject to minimal standards and protocols, Simpson said at the time. I would caution the district attorneys that whoever they get to do these autopsies, that person isn't going to be subject to any state law or oversight, and they're going to have to defend the results in court. Of course, the lack of oversight was precisely the point. It was also the arrangement under which Hain had operated for most of his career. State Representative Robert Evans, who had introduced the legislation to fund and hire a new state medical examiner the previous year, was also irritated by what Hood and the coroners had done. He warned that if the coroner's plan came to fruition, he'd seek new legislation to stop it. Over the next few months, Hood and Governor Barbour began receiving letters of support for Hain from law enforcement officials across the state. The overarching theme of the letters was that there couldn't possibly be any truth to the allegations against Hain because the prosecutors who wrote the letters had never heard complaints about Hain from other prosecutors. The president of the Mississippi Sheriff's Association wrote to declare his support for Hain as an invaluable tool to law enforcement. Forrest Allgood wrote Barbour, too, though he confessed that he couldn't understand why his effort was even necessary. Many accusations have been made against him of late, Allgood wrote, referring to Hain. It seems he works too hard, sleeps too little, and testifies too much. This is Mississippi. We are a poor state, and we are all understaffed. I know I am. Consequently, we all have to do more. District Attorney Jim Powell fretted over what he would do with all the homicide cases in his district for which he was preparing to call Hain as a witness. Now defense attorneys were going to ask questions about Hain's competence and credibility. Powell urged Barbour to reinstate Hain. He also denounced the propaganda from the Innocence Project and expressed his displeasure that the taxpayers had to continue to fund it, a reference to the organization's affiliation with the University of Mississippi. A few years later, attorneys from the Mississippi Innocence Project would help solve a grisly murder that had haunted a town in Powell's district for 15 years. Through some diligence and communication with the state crime lab, the attorneys helped find the man who killed Kathy Mabry, a crime law enforcement had never been able to solve. In the late 1990s, the decision by local officials to ask West to examine Mabry's body had led to the arrest of the wrong man. That man remained in jail for a year before he was cleared by DNA testing. The case then went cold until the defense attorneys solved it in 2012. At about the same time these letters arrived at the offices of Barbour and Hood, defense attorneys across Mississippi also received a letter from a newly formed company called Pathology Consultations, Inc. The letter began, "We are pleased to announce that Stephen Hain, M.D., will be available immediately to assist criminal defense attorneys in the state of Mississippi." Among his many other qualifications, the letter noted that Hain is board certified in forensic pathology. Chapter 15. No Reckoning. The truth does not change according to our ability to stomach it emotionally. Flannery O'Connor. Stephen Hain has maintained that most of the criticism directed at him is just cherry-picking. His defenders argue that he did tens of thousands of autopsies in Mississippi, and in the vast majority of them, no one complained about the quality of his work. Likewise, in the vast majority of the cases in which he testified, his testimony wasn't at all controversial. Even for those cases in which his testimony was challenged by other medical examiners, his conclusions were rarely dispositive of guilt. There was often plenty of other evidence against the accused. There's a good deal of truth in all of these points. There's also a lot of truth in Haynes' contention that he was providing a service for Mississippi, that the state faced a critical shortage of medical examiners, and he was only doing what was asked of him. No one would doubt that Haynes put in long, hard hours of work over many years. His schedule was grueling and would have quickly worn out just about anyone. But it is also important to remember that all of this was by design. Haynes did approximately 4 out of every 5 autopsies in the state because that's the arrangement that Haynes and most of the state's DAs and coroners wanted and fought for. And as this book has shown, the workload itself was a huge part of the problem. Every medical examiner consulted for this book said that it's simply impossible to perform anywhere near that volume of autopsies with the care, precision, and best practices required of the profession. When confronted with these opinions, Haynes has simply insisted that he isn't your average medical examiner. In the past, noted medical examiner Michael Bodden, a personal friend of Haynes, has criticized Haynes in individual cases, but has defended Haynes' professionalism and credibility in the press and in affidavits. Yet in many of the cases documented in this book, cases where Haynes' testimony was critical to the outcome of a case, his approach to the work appears to have been less rather than more rigorous, and was at times characterized by a willingness to testify outside of his expertise and to draw conclusions that have little basis in science. Haynes has also pointed out in testimony that some of his critics have themselves been embroiled in scandal. After his death, for example, Louisiana medical examiner George McCormick was shown to have signed off on autopsies he didn't do. Thomas Bennett, the second state medical examiner in Mississippi, has come under fire after a series of shaken baby syndrome diagnoses in Iowa and Montana. Bennett preceded Haynes and was a critic of the Mississippi system, not of Haynes in particular. Georgia state medical examiner and longtime Haynes critic Chris Sperry retired in 2015 after a newspaper investigation found he was billing the state for time he was testifying as a private consultant. Interestingly, among the criticisms of Sperry were that he had a caseload that ranked among the highest in the country. But that investigation found that between public and private, Sperry had performed or reviewed 366 autopsies over a 4-year period, a total Haynes regularly cleared in a month. Haynes views his role in the Brooks and Brewer cases as minimal. In filings for the lawsuit filed against him by the two exonerees, Haynes' attorney argues that Haynes is not responsible for either conviction, that he never stated that the marks on the victims were human bites, he only suspected as much, and that it was West, not Haynes, who made the identifications that implicated Brooks and Brewer. In his 2012 deposition for his own lawsuit against the Innocence Project of New York, Haynes made similar comments. He said he was suspicious that the marks on the girls were human bites, he said, but that was beyond my expertise. But Haynes' autopsy report on Courtney Smith clearly stated that there were bite marks on the girl. Likewise, Haynes' testimony in the Brewer case belies his claim that only West, and not he, ever stated that the marks on the girl were human bites. At Brooks's trial, Forrest Allgood asked Haynes to draw on his training and expertise after having examined thousands of bodies to state to a reasonable medical certainty whether or not these marks that you found on this child's body that you perceive could very well be bite marks, or whether or not they were the result of insect activity. Haynes replied, "I did not think that they were insect bites." Haynes has also tried to further distance himself from Michael West more generally. In his 2012 deposition for his lawsuit against the Innocence Project of New York, Haynes said he thought the West phenomenon was a little excessive. He also claimed that he tried to convince West that the ultraviolet method needed to be proven effective and reliable by a scientific study. West wouldn't comply, so I stopped using it. I wanted to see a scientific study. Yet at the same time, he insisted, I didn't have doubts about his prior uses of the technique, because it's an old process. But he added, but I think if you introduce it in a court of law, you have to have a scientific study where you can show error rates. Those statements are hard to reconcile. Haynes' efforts to distance himself from West are also hard to reconcile with the fact that the two men co-authored articles together on the technique, marketed the technique, and that Haynes employed West well after West's methods had been widely criticized. Haynes has also admitted that he himself has used West's highly controversial method of pushing a suspect's dental mold directly into the victim's skin. Haynes also said in that deposition that he no longer trusts bite mark analysis in general. I would be very reluctant to call in a forensic odontologist to do a bite mark comparison study, he said. It's not a fingerprint, it's not DNA. With these statements, and his statements in the Jeffrey Havard case, Haynes seems to acknowledge the use of bad science during his time in Mississippi, and that injustices may have occurred as a result. But other than conceding in Havard that he, and a lot of others, may have been wrong about shaken baby syndrome, he has yet to acknowledge his own culpability in any of it. As the rebelling coroners and prosecutors planned their mini-coup against the Department of Public Safety, State Representative Robert Evans made good on his promise for a legislative response. In early 2010, he and other state lawmakers introduced a bill that required any doctor performing an autopsy for the state of Mississippi to be both board-certified in forensic pathology by the American Board of Pathology and deemed qualified by the Department of Public Safety. When the bill unanimously passed the state Senate, Haynes and Hood sprang into action and began lobbying state representatives to defeat it. Hood disseminated an email calling the bill an Innocence Project bill which threatens cases which involved Stephen Haynes, and promised, "Our office is working diligently to stop this potentially harmful legislation." Among other things, Hood's lobbying clearly suggested that so long as he was in the Attorney General's office, there would be no serious review of old cases to find other potentially innocent people Haynes' testimony may have helped convict. In public, Hood's office insisted that he took no position on the bill. He couldn't support the bill. It thwarted his behind-the-scenes effort to bring back Haynes. But to oppose a bill requiring that doctors who perform state autopsies be certified by the group widely recognized as the gold standard in forensic pathology might raise some eyebrows. So Hood remained neutral on the bill in public, even as he privately lobbied to kill it. The Mississippi legislature passed the law anyway by a vote of 91-31. Governor Haley Barbour signed it into law. Several months after the new law passed, Haynes received a letter from his old friends at the American College of Forensic Examiners Institute, ACFEI, congratulating him on his newly achieved status of Certified Forensic Physician, a position that, according to the group's website, holds an integral role in determining the outcome of many important court cases. The cost for the new certification, $869. In what appeared to be a last-gasp attempt to get back in the game, in May 2010, Haynes sent a letter to the Mississippi Attorney General's office inquiring whether his new ACFEI certification, which was still pending at the time, along with his recertification from the American Board of Forensic Pathology, fulfilled the requirements of the new law. A state legislature could and should require some minimum qualifications before allowing someone to perform autopsies paid for by the state. Here, the legislature had made its intent pretty clear. Hood's office had no choice but to tell Haynes that his request would ultimately be answered by the Department of Public Safety. And DPS Commissioner Simpson had already made his intent clear. All of which meant that the challenges, schemes, and appeals had come to an end. Haynes was finally finished doing autopsies for the state of Mississippi. A more daunting task remained, a thorough accounting of the damage and persuading state officials to fix it. "I wish now that I had been more courageous," says Edwin Pittman, the former Chief Justice of the Mississippi Supreme Court. "A couple of those old cases embarrass me now. We should have been less accepting of Hayne and that culture." Pittman, now in his early 80s, retired from the court in 2004. He has likely held more high state offices than anyone in Mississippi's history. Before joining the court in 1989, he had been a state senator, state treasurer, secretary of state, state attorney general, and brigadier general in the Mississippi National Guard. Pittman's tenure on the court began just as the careers of Stephen Hayne and Michael West were taking off, and lasted through all but the tail end of their dominance of the state's death investigation system. As a justice, he reviewed 46 cases in which Hayne was a witness, second only to Justices Chuck McRae and James Smith. He didn't throw out Hayne's testimony in any of them. To be fair, Pittman was on the court as Hayne became ingrained in the state's criminal justice system, and he retired before there had been much public criticism of Hayne. Defendants had only challenged Hayne's testimony in a few of the cases Pittman heard while he was on the bench. Still, Pittman himself relied on Hayne while he was attorney general. He defended convictions that had been won based on Hayne's testimony. He now says he wishes that he and his colleagues had been more skeptical. "There could be a herd mentality on the court. There was always a strong majority of justices that were just always accepting of prosecutors and expert testimony. At the time," he says, "Mississippi had no state medical examiner, so there was no one backing up, verifying the work Hayne and West were doing. All the DAs believed in Hayne. We probably had more confidence and trust in the DAs than we should have, more than I do now." After retiring, Pittman grew increasingly alarmed as additional information came out about Hayne's record and Mississippi officials' reaction to the revelations. His thoughtfulness and willingness to speak out are as courageous as they are rare. "What ultimately shocked me were the numbers of autopsies that Hayne was doing. When you see those kinds of numbers, you realize that they're impossible." He adds that Hayne's personality is probably why he was able to elude criticism longer than West. Pittman bears more responsibility for his role in enabling West. The feisty dentist was directly challenged several times while Pittman was on the court. In fact, Pittman heard 8 cases involving West's testimony. Only 2 other justices heard more. Pittman upheld West's testimony in all but one of those cases, and in that case, the bologna sandwich case, he voted with the majority, who faulted West not for claiming he could exclude or include people as sources of the bites in the partially eaten sandwich, but for destroying the evidence. Pittman most regrets his 1997 majority opinion in the LaVon Brooks case, which upheld West's testimony, Brooks's conviction, and the life sentence. "Looking back, I can't believe that I bought into all of that. That I believed West's science was really science. I wish I had voted differently." Pittman says there was a strong pro-death penalty culture on the court in the 1990s. Part of that culture was driven by ideology. There was a sense that if a death penalty case came to us, that that was the jury's decision and it ought not be interfered with, he says. Since then, he has learned how bias can limit how authorities view those cases. "Experience eventually taught me that it really began with the DA. Once the DA decided he was going to seek the death penalty, it was really all downhill from there." Pittman recalls a couple of DAs who were careful about when they sought death for a murder suspect, but others sought death in nearly every murder case. The death penalty wasn't being applied based on the merits of the case or the seriousness of the crime, but on the politics and aggressiveness of the local prosecutor. 5 years after retiring from the court, Pittman, now a lawyer, filed a post-conviction petition on behalf of a man who had been convicted partly as a result of questionable testimony from Stephen Hayne. In the brief, Pittman made the same arguments many others had before him. Pittman's former colleagues unanimously rejected the petition. "I'm not a finance person," Stephen Hayne once said in a deposition. "I'm a physician, and I never paid that much attention, you know, to the finances." If Hayne was doing around 80% of Mississippi's public autopsies over the span of 15 to 20 years, he grossed well over $10 million from taxpayers during that span. To complicate matters, in 2014, Hayne's former business partner, Cecil McCrory, was indicted for a bribery and kickback scheme involving officials at the state's Department of Corrections. McCrory has held a number of public offices in Mississippi, including state representative, county commissioner, sheriff's department investigator, school board chairman, and justice court judge. Hayne wasn't implicated in the investigation that ultimately sent McCrory to prison, but his longtime partnership with a man now serving time, their unusual business arrangement, their opaqueness about the business, and McCrory's contacts in state government raise some legitimate public interest questions. In 1991, McCrory started a company called Investigative Research. McCrory himself had been certified in fire investigations, another area of forensics heavily criticized in recent years as it has been subjected to scientific scrutiny, and most of his early clients were insurance companies that hired him to investigate claims for possible arson. At the same time, he was serving as a state legislator and was chairman of PEER, the legislature's oversight committee structure that investigated official corruption. It was also the committee that issued reports critical of the state's death investigation system in 1988 and again in 2008, reports that urged the state to stop contracting autopsies out to private doctors, though neither report was published while McCrory was on the committee. When Hayne joined Investigative Research around 1995, the company started taking on pathology consultations as well. The word company might give the wrong impression. The staff usually consisted of McCrory, Hayne, and perhaps an administrative assistant or two. McCrory processed the money Hayne made from consulting in civil cases. Once the arrangement had been set up, when opposing counsel would ask Hayne questions about his income in such cases, he'd often simply defer to McCrory. In criminal cases in particular, defense attorneys rarely had the time or the inclination to follow up by subpoenaing McCrory or his records. After losing his seat in the legislature in 1996, McCrory also began lobbying his former colleagues on behalf of both the Coroner's Association and the Sheriff's Association, two groups whose members had enormous influence over the assigning of autopsies and thus would have been of particular interest to Hayne. It's difficult to ascertain the exact nature of Hayne and McCrory's business relationship, except to say that it was odd. According to sworn testimony from both men, McCrory handled all the money, did all the paperwork, and kept all the records from Hayne's consultations in private cases. He then deposited the money from Hayne's clients into a slush fund, from which he wrote checks at Hayne's request. While the money was Hayne's to do with as he pleased, according to McCrory, Hayne never had access to the account himself. He always had to go through McCrory. According to McCrory, at any given time, the account balance would be around $50,000 to $60,000. It also isn't clear what position Hayne held at IR. For most of the 1990s, Hayne testified that he was a partner at the firm. In 2001, he testified that McCrory owned 100% of the company, meaning that his testimony in who knows how many cases until that point had been mistaken. In 2003, Hayne went back again. When asked who owned the company, he replied, "Technically, Cecil McCrory and myself." McCrory testified in 2012 that Hayne didn't own, and had never owned, a stake in the company. According to McCrory, during Hayne's most lucrative years in the early 2000s, he was bringing in $250,000 per year for investigative research, although in a 2005 deposition, Hayne claimed he was billing half that much. Yet McCrory and Hayne have insisted in sworn testimony that Hayne made almost no money from his civil cases. Testifying at a deposition, for example, Hain claimed that 0% of his income came from civil cases. Odder still, he said in the same deposition that just 5, 7, 8% of his income came from criminal cases. Hain repeatedly made similar claims. He has often said that he made no money from IR, save for $1,000 every 5 years. He has claimed his accountant told him the IRS requires this minimum amount so that his consulting isn't classified as a hobby. It isn't clear what Hain meant by that. When McCrory was asked about this alleged IRS rule in a 2012 deposition, he replied, "I don't know what he's talking about." Despite Hain's claims, McCrory at times paid him sums much larger than $1,000. When asked about a $25,000 check he received from the company in the 1990s, Hain said it was reimbursement for a conference room that a local hospital had been letting him use. But McCrory also cut him 4 more checks of $25,000 to $34,000 in 2007 and 2008. Hain has never been asked about those. When McCrory was asked under oath, he replied, "I don't have a vague recollection of why I did that." Hain has testified that he left investigative research in the early part of 2000. McCrory has testified that Hain left in 2008. When asked where all of the money went, if not to him, Hain has repeatedly testified that he gave it all away to pay for office equipment and salaries, to students, and to various charities. But when asked to produce records of all of these transactions, he has claimed that they've been destroyed, or that he entrusted all his record-keeping to McCrory, to his accountant, or to his ex-wife. Though both Hain and McCrory have claimed that Hain was enormously generous, both say he also gave away his money in ways that didn't create a paper trail. Hain frequently claimed to give lots of money to charity, but he rarely named any specific charitable organizations. Instead, he has said that he engaged in more individualized charity, the kind that leaves no public record. According to McCrory, about 90% of the charitable donations Hain made were to kids going to college. How did Hain find these kids? They seemed to find him. Once somebody tells that they got a contribution or donation for books, word gets around. He had more requests than he had money. In 2012, Hain and McCrory claimed that Hain sometimes even paid these students full tuition. Both claimed that Hain once bought a student a car and sent another to Europe. McCrory testified that Hain also often gave money to someone simply because McCrory requested it. "I actually have asked him to donate to some people who I would come across who just, you know, didn't have any food or whatever in the house. And he never questioned it. He was always supportive of that," McCrory said. All of this certainly seems extraordinarily kind. Yet between them, Hain and McCrory couldn't remember the names of a single recipient of such generosity. When asked in 2012, Hain had vague recollections of his connections to at least 2 students he had helped, but couldn't recall their names. And yet some have said he has an incredibly precise, almost photographic memory. Hain did remember that he always made checks out to the students themselves, not the educational institutions. He said the reason for this was that he didn't want the students to think he didn't trust them. That also meant that the college or university would have no record of his check. When asked in 2012 to name the last time he had made such a gift to a college student, Hain hesitated, then said it was probably in the late 1990s. He was later shown a 2004 deposition in which he claimed that at that time he was putting a student through college. Hain also periodically paid West to work for him, sometimes at Jimmy Roberts' morgue, sometimes at investigative research. Hain at one time loaned West a lot of money, apparently to help pay off a tax bill, and may have asked West to work it off by assisting him with his autopsies. Over the years, Hain has often claimed he netted very little money from his autopsies, citing his obligation to pay for administrative staff and supplies. But when challenged on exactly who paid those expenses on his behalf, he has said he isn't sure. He isn't even sure who sent his staff their tax forms. One former coroner said he didn't know what the fiduciary deal was between Hain, West, and Roberts, but Mike West was always around when Hain did autopsies. Once Hain brought West over when he did an autopsy for me here. Then I got a bill from West for consulting. I refused to pay it, and I told Steve never to let that happen again. Another coroner says he refused to work with Hain so long as West was present at Hain's autopsies. I was always pretty sure that West was hiding in the back room at Mississippi Mortuary. I knew he was there, even if you couldn't see him. Hain has often testified that for most of his career, he didn't worry about money because his wife handled all of their financial affairs, personal and business. "My wife, Anne, was a meticulous person with all the finances," he said in 2012. "She could tell me how many socks I bought each month for the last 15 years. When Anne Hain herself was asked about her ex-husband's finances by a private investigator for the Innocence Project in 2012, she said that while she was certain that Hain, West, and Roberts had some kind of financial partnership, "You won't find it in writing. I looked." By his own testimony and that of his business associates then, Hain made little to no effort to track who owed him money, how much money he made, whom he paid to help him, and how much, and to whom he lent and gave money. All of his financial affairs were apparently handled by either his wife, Anne, until they divorced, Cecil McCrory, Jimmy Roberts, though both deny they ever had a business relationship, or his accountant. But all of those people, to varying degrees, have disagreed with both Hain and one another on the specifics of how Hain's finances were handled. Figuring out Hain's total income over the years can also be a difficult task. But it's possible to at least make some estimates based on his testimony. Hain has testified that he made about $170,000 per year from his position at the renal lab, and that his compensation for his work at Rankin Medical Center ranged from $140,000 a year when he started to $200,000 a year when he left. He was also bringing in $150,000 to $300,000 per year from his consulting work on private cases. Of course, the bulk of Hain's income came from state autopsies and the work associated with them, and at the height of his career, he was grossing well over $1 million per year from those. Taken together, Hain's work grossed in the neighborhood of $1.5 million to $2 million per year, not including what he made for serving on various boards and holding various titles at hospitals, medical research facilities, and startups. Hain's lifestyle certainly reflected that sort of income. According to divorce records, when Hain and his second wife Tanya split in 2008, the couple owned several nice automobiles and three properties, including a 6,000-square-foot house valued at $1 million and 81 acres in Rankin County. Over the course of their short marriage, Hain spent over $317,000 at the Lee Michaels jewelry store. After his divorce from his first wife, Anne, Hain began paying her $150,000 per year in alimony. And then there are the records themselves. Hain, West, and McCrory have apparently lost or destroyed most of their financial records, personal records, autopsy records, and correspondence with police and prosecutors over the years. Hain said in his 2012 Innocence Project deposition that most of his records from civil cases were destroyed when a pipe burst and flooded his home. As for his autopsy records from criminal cases, he said he had transferred all of those to the state crime lab. Michael West has had similar problems. When asked in recent depositions to bring all records he still had from all of the cases in which he had consulted or testified, West has brought in only his CV. According to West, some of his records were destroyed after he stored them in a friend's barn and the barn subsequently burned down. Others were destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. Any that remained had been thrown out by his wife. West also said he kept no backup files of the photographs he took for his cases. He has said he failed to back up any of his data and lost more of his records when each of his three hard drives crashed. Like Hain, West also dismissed his foggy memory about finances by citing his lack of interest in such matters. When asked a question about Jimmy Roberts's finances, West replied, "If you look in this CV, you will never see the word accountant." It's a similar story with Cecil McCrory. When deposed by the Innocence Project in 2012, McCrory said he had only kept documents from investigative research going back to 2009, 1 year after, he says, Hain left the company. As for the donations Hain had made to students and charitable organizations, McCrory said the only record he made of them was in the registry for the checkbook for Hain's account, and he had thrown that out years ago. McCrory also had none of Hain's tax returns, nor any of the company's tax records from the years of Hain's employment. He also had no transcripts of Hain's trial testimony in the cases for which investigative research had been paid for Hain's services. McCrory was indicted by federal prosecutors in 2014. According to the initial indictments, McCrory had started several new companies and through them had paid nearly $1 million in bribes to Mississippi Department of Corrections Commissioner Christopher Epps in exchange for Epps awarding no-bid contracts to McCrory's clients and businesses, including investigative research. The indictments later expanded to include more people and allegations of fraud affecting over $800 million in corrections contracts. According to federal officials, Epps and McCrory were the two central figures in the massive scheme. In February 2017, McCrory was sentenced to 8.5 years in prison. Hain wasn't implicated in any of his former business partners' shady dealings with the state's prison system, but he has said that he was personally affected by McCrory's indictment. "I feel just horrible that this has happened," he told the Clarion Ledger. "It makes me sick to my stomach." Hain may have finally been barred from doing state autopsies in Mississippi, but with just a few exceptions, the state's public officials seem uninterested in revisiting his old cases. Attorney General Jim Hood has arguably possessed the most power to order a thorough review of Hain's previous work. At the very least, Hood could have told his staff to halt pending prosecutions until he could find other medical examiners to review Hain's testimony and autopsy reports. After all, we now know that two men have been wrongly convicted of rape and murder. One of them was nearly executed, and a little girl died whose death might have been prevented. Perhaps some introspection was in order. Instead, within weeks of the Brooks and Brewer exonerations, Hood took to the press to defend Forrest Allgood. Hood called Allgood a straight arrow who always played it by the rules. That comment didn't age well. 2 years later, Allgood and Judge James T. Kitchens were upbraided by a federal judge for allowing false testimony in a separate death penalty trial. Hood also continued to publicly defend Hain. In 2010, he tried to refute the allegation that Hain shilled for prosecutors by telling the Sun-Herald that Hain had testified for the defense in some cases Hood had personally prosecuted. But the public record of cases for which Hain had testified for the defense prior to his termination at all is spare. And there's no appellate court opinion in any case in which Hood was the prosecutor and Hain testified for the defense. That doesn't necessarily mean that it never happened, but if it did, it was rare. When Hood's office was asked for a list of such cases, no one responded. Hood later took a slightly different line on Hain and West. In a 2011 interview with the Jackson Free Press, Hood claimed he had never publicly defended Hain. He also told the paper that Michael West is someone we have investigated, and I don't support him in any matter. He was being duplicitous. At the very same time that he made those statements, Hood's office was arguing in cases like Lee Stubbs and Eddie Lee Howard that the defendants were procedurally barred from challenging West's credibility. Publicly, Hood was admitting that West wasn't a credible witness. Less publicly, his office was simultaneously arguing legal technicalities to keep people in prison and on death row who had been convicted because of West's testimony. Hood has steadfastly refused to consider a task force or any broad review of Haines' work. In a 2011 TV interview, he did claim that his office had opened an investigation into 20 cases involving Michael West. But when asked for a list of those cases, or even the name of the attorney who was heading up the investigation, the office responded, "We cannot release any of the information you are requesting at this time." Hood is one of the most PR-savvy attorneys general in the country. He has never been shy about trumpeting his accomplishments. He often holds press conferences to announce new initiatives and major investigations. Yet here, his office has been suspiciously quiet. A few months after Hood's statement about investigating West, in a hearing for the Lee Stubbs case, an assistant attorney general from Hood's office was asked who was running the alleged investigation of Michael West. The assistant attorney general replied that he was. When asked about the status of the investigation, he replied that he had done no more than a Westlaw search on West's name, the legal equivalent of a Google search. As of this writing, Hood's office has offered no new information about any investigation into Michael West. Still, Hood's obstinacy about Hain and West has never hurt him at the polls. In January 2011, DPS Commissioner Steve Simpson announced that he'd challenge Hood for Attorney General. By the time the campaign was in full swing, Simpson had not only fired Hain, but also appointed Mississippi's first state medical examiner in 16 years, Mark Levon, a forensic pathologist from Buffalo, New York. "I hired Mississippi's first state medical examiner in more than a decade. Jim Hood fought me on that," Simpson said in the August before the election. "I'd be delighted for this to become a campaign issue." In the end, it didn't matter much. Simpson didn't really push Hain, West, and death investigations as a campaign issue, and neither did the press. As a Republican running for statewide office in Mississippi, calling for a review of thousands of murder convictions was probably never going to be a winning campaign issue for him. By Election Day, most of the press and public were more interested in a mini-scandal over Simpson's request to be reimbursed for a $400 dinner he and some colleagues had eaten at a steakhouse 2 years earlier. Hood went on to clobber Simpson by 22 points. The courts were more of a mixed bag. In the 2011 case, Gauss v. State, the Mississippi Supreme Court finally showed some signs of movement when it came to Hain, but these were still only the tiniest of fissures. The justices found that while the court had previously found Hain to be qualified to testify as a forensic pathologist, that should not be taken as eternal, non-expiring judicial anointment of Dr. Hain as an expert pathologist for all of time, and in every case in which he might thereafter be tendered to offer expert testimony. That at least was something. Yet when it was time to vote, the court still rejected the challenge to Hain in that case too, because it found that the defense attorneys hadn't sufficiently challenged Hain's credibility at trial. In March 2013, the court finally threw out Hain's testimony for a second time. In a unanimous decision, the justices ordered a new trial for David Parvin, a former Mississippi State University professor who had been convicted of killing his wife. In that trial, Hain testified that he could tell by the shot pattern in Joyce Parvin's skin that the gun that killed her was fired at shoulder height, not at waist height as Parvin had claimed. Despite never inspecting the gun or even knowing what type of shotgun it was, Hain also said he could tell by the shot pattern in Joyce's skin that the gun had been fired from 4 feet away, again contradicting David Parvin's story. The state Supreme Court didn't buy it. With unusually pointed criticism, the court ruled that Hain's testimony was woefully short of the requirements for admissibility. Furthermore, the court ruled that the speculative expert opinions should never have been put before a jury. The court also seemed to be onto Hain's tactic of writing vague autopsy reports, then elaborating on the fly at trial. Quoting Parvin's brief, the court noted that the measurements in Hain's autopsy report were made without comment, explanation, or support, and none of these measurements could be determined by the autopsy report or any of the related scientific tests. Hayne had waited until trial to spring those details on the defense, as he'd done many times before. This time, the court called him on it. Hayne and a few of the prosecutors who regularly used him often engaged in a misleading and manipulative use of hypotheticals. This isn't uncommon, but Hayne and some prosecutors were particularly deft at it. A prosecutor might ask Hayne if a crime could have happened in a way that contradicted the testimony of or otherwise implicated the accused. Hayne would reply in the affirmative. The prosecutor would then tell jurors in his closing argument that Hayne's testimony was proof of the defendant's culpability or evidence that the defendant's version was implausible. If challenged during cross-examination or later criticized, Hayne could always point out that he was merely responding to a hypothetical, or that he had merely said his findings were consistent with the hypothetical, not that he thought the crime could only have occurred that way. How prosecutors then used his answer in their closing arguments, in other words, wasn't his responsibility. The majority opinion in Parvin points out that using Hayne's measurements and observations, prosecutors concocted a possible scenario of how the shooting occurred. Though there was no scientific evidence to suggest that particular scenario was certain, or even probable, the jury was nonetheless shown a detailed computer animation based only on Hayne's approximations, which Hayne then affirmed in his testimony. The court noted that the only scientific method or principle appearing in the record was the ipsy-dixit or self-proclaimed accuracy of Hayne. In the few years leading up to the Parvin decision, the Mississippi Innocence Project had been compiling a long and comprehensive dossier on Hayne, which attorneys for the organization then used to file appeals or post-conviction petitions. Parvin's case was one of those still on appeal. But for those who had exhausted their state appeals, the federal courts were the only remaining option. The problem is that absent a DNA test, it has become nearly impossible to get a federal court to order a new trial. Under the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, AEDPA, in order for a federal court to order a new trial on the basis of new evidence, a defendant must show that A. there is new evidence, B. that evidence could not have been discovered at the time of trial, C. the petition has been filed within 1 year of when the new evidence could reasonably have been discovered, and D. the new evidence would likely have altered the jury's verdict. It's an exceedingly high bar, and the Tavares-Flags case illustrates just how high it is. After the Mississippi Supreme Court denied Flags's post-conviction relief, his lawyers with the Mississippi Innocence Project went to federal court, backed by their new dossier on Hayne. Flags is the case in which Hayne had contradicted the defendant's self-defense claim with speculative blood spatter testimony based on photos of discoloration on a wall near the crime scene. In January 2014, a three-judge panel for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit turned Flags down with a curt four-paragraph opinion. Flags had based his claim on revelations from the 2012 deposition that Hayne had given in his lawsuit against the Innocence Project. The court wasn't impressed. The judges wrote that Hayne had been widely and publicly criticized for several years before the 2012 deposition, and certainly before the filing of Flags' first application in 2011. Indeed, the deposition merely revisits the facts compiled in the Innocence Project's letter. That was all true. Yet it was also true that both state and federal courts had been rejecting challenges to Hayne's credibility throughout that period of time. Nevertheless, the panel ruled that Flags had failed at Part C of the AEDPA test. He hadn't filed his petition within 1 year of when the new evidence could reasonably have been discovered. For good measure, the panel added that even if he had made the deadline, Flags hadn't convinced them that Hayne wasn't a credible witness. Moreover, Flags does not show that Haynes' testimony at trial was false or unreliable, they wrote. Nor does he show, by clear and convincing evidence, that no jury would have convicted him but for the allegedly unconstitutional admission of Haynes' opinion testimony. 10 months after that ruling, a 3-judge panel from the same Court of Appeals issued a stunning decision in a separate challenge to Haynes. That ruling was also short, and might have been easy to overlook, but it included one critically important sentence. It was a damning sentence, damning for the Court of Appeals and damning of the criminal justice system in general. When taken with the ruling 10 months earlier, which again was issued by the same appeals court, that single sentence illustrated as well as anything could how the courts and AEDPA have made it next to impossible for those wrongly convicted by bad forensic testimony to even be heard, much less find their way out of prison. Here's what happened. In the second case, a panel from the same Fifth Circuit unanimously denied a new trial for a Louisiana man named James Coon, who had been convicted in 1996 of killing an infant. Haynes was the state's expert witness. In his petition, Coon claimed that the recent revelations about Haynes' credibility were newly discovered evidence. As in Flags, the panel unanimously rejected that claim. As with the previous panel, this panel ruled that Coon should have discovered allegations made by Haynes' critics years earlier. But this particular opinion included two important words that proved Coon's and appellants like him never really stood a chance. The evidence shows the witness for Louisiana, Dr. Stephen Haynes, a now discredited Mississippi coroner, lied about his qualifications as an expert and thus gave unreliable testimony about the cause of death. Now discredited. This was the first time a majority opinion from an appeals court of any kind had acknowledged that Haynes had been discredited. Not only that, the opinion acknowledged that Haynes had lied about his credentials. Unfortunately, because of what that panel did next, the acknowledgement provided no relief for the people trying to get a new trial by challenging Haynes' credibility. That's because, despite the fact that this was the first time an appeals court had described Haynes as discredited, it was already too late to do anything about it. The federal district court judge who first ruled on Coon's petition determined that despite the evidence that Haynes had been discredited, Dr. Haynes' expertise was questioned by the Mississippi Supreme Court in an opinion published in May 2007. Justice Diaz's special concurrence relied upon a magazine article published in 2006. In the absence of any evidence to the contrary, it is safe to conclude that a habeas petitioner exercising due diligence should have discovered this information well before the fall of 2011. In other words, this petition is clearly time-barred. The Fifth Circuit panel agreed. The panel noted that several media outlets had first begun to criticize Haynes between 2006 and 2008, that the Innocence Project had filed its complaint against Haynes in 2009, and that Mississippi Supreme Court Justice Oliver Diaz had criticized him in his concurring opinion in the Edmonds case in 2007. Coon's assertion that he could not have learned of Edmonds from information in the Louisiana State Penitentiary Law Library is both implausible and immaterial in the light of the public information about Dr. Haynes that was available for several years prior to July 2011, the court wrote. Because Coon could have discovered these criticisms of Haynes much earlier, he had missed his deadline. He was out of luck. With a single short opinion, the Fifth Circuit admitted that the medical examiner Mississippi had been using for 2 decades was no longer a credible witness, but then slammed the door on anyone he had helped convict. Under a precise reading of federal law and the relevant case law, this was arguably correct. It was also incredibly unfair and a stark illustration of just how ill-equipped the federal courts and federal law are to catch and correct quackery disguised as expertise. Since the onset of DNA testing in the 1990s, the legal system has slowly been coming to terms with the fact that forensic analysts aren't nearly as accurate and reliable as they've often claimed to be. The problem has been documented in countless studies, reports, and law review articles, but the most damning evidence is the most straightforward. According to a 2007 study of the first 200 post-conviction exonerations, over half involved flawed forensic evidence. In the majority of those cases, the state's forensic witnesses gave inaccurate and unreliable testimony. And even as the criminal justice system can't seem to keep bad science out of its courtrooms, once someone is convicted, the same system then shifts to protect the finality of the verdict. Federal lawmakers have only made it worse with laws like AEDPA, altering federal code to make it ever more difficult to challenge state verdicts in federal court. The courts still let these witnesses testify at trial as experts. But years later, when science proves them wrong, or the defendant finally finds funds to hire an expert to say as much, the system is all about protecting the verdict. At that point, it no longer wants to hear from experts. But science doesn't operate on deadlines. It's a process. DNA has shown us that defendants who expert witnesses said without equivocation were guilty were unquestionably innocent. Unfortunately, the fact that unproven expertise caused a wrongful conviction in some cases hasn't been enough for the courts to reconsider other convictions in which the primary evidence came from those same disproven fields, or in a disturbing number of cases, even from the same expert, but for which post-conviction DNA testing isn't dispositive of guilt. Most of these more subjective forensics fields have largely avoided exposing themselves to scientific scrutiny. It's easy to see why. There's no incentive for them to do so. The purpose of forensics is to solve crimes. The end game is to testify in court and persuade a judge or jury. Once the courts begin accepting analysts from a new area of forensics as experts, there's no upside to those analysts then subjecting their methods and analysis to scientific scrutiny. They already have the only approval they need, that of the courts. If the science affirms their methods, they're no better off than they were before. At best, they get the benefit of telling the jury that their field is backed by scientific research. As we've seen with West, anyone can claim as much, regardless of whether it's true. But if their field doesn't withstand scientific scrutiny, it's free material for opposing attorneys. It could put their entire livelihood at risk, or at least it ought to. Because so many of these forensic specialties haven't sought out scientific validation, and because of the pervasive tension between science and law, scientists have been slow to scrutinize their claims. That began to change after the first DNA exonerations in the early 1990s, but full-fledged scientific scrutiny of forensics didn't really get going until the last decade or so. The scientific process is slow and deliberate. A study will get submitted for peer review. It might then be published. Other studies come along to verify that study, contradict it, or refine it in some way. There's no set point in time at which science officially declares a theory to be proven or disproven. It's about the process itself. It's about the gradual accumulation of knowledge. Courts operate under entirely different rules. Statutes of limitations toll. Procedural rules impose deadlines. And there's all of that emphasis on finality. With science, no theory is final. Revision and correction are encouraged. Judges and prosecutors, on the other hand, seem to feel that the very integrity of their system demands the certainty of a closed tomb. Institutionally, the two systems operate in fundamentally different ways. We've known this since lawyers and medical doctors first began quarreling about death investigations in the early 20th century. Yet we still haven't figured out how to reconcile these differences. Imagine that defendant Johnny is convicted based on handwriting analysis evidence. This particular variety of expert testimony has been criticized for many years, but has only been acknowledged as invalid by government agencies in the last few years. Johnny now wants to file a post-conviction petition for a new trial based on the scientific consensus that the evidence used to convict him